I'm joined on Radio Jackie today by the Liberal Democrats MP for Epsom and Ewell, Helen Maguire. What feedback are you getting from residents about cuts to disability benefits and winter fuel payments currently?
Yeah, so interestingly, last night I had a meeting with a huge number of constituents who are currently in receipt of PIP, constituents who are deaf and have other disabilities. And what's really interesting is that actually many of them really weren't aware of the bill going through and how it would affect them. So they were incredibly alarmed at how the bill might affect them. I mean, obviously this morning we've now heard that there'll be some U-turns, and we'll wait to hear the detail from that. But, you know, we've also heard similar feedback throughout the winter about the winter fuel payment. There have been so many constituents who've been struggling, quite frankly, between feeding and heating their homes. And they're now delighted that the government has, again, made a U-turn and that they recognise that there are indeed many pensioners who do require this winter fuel payment in the cold months.
Yeah, I want to ask you about those U-turns. What do you make of the government's decision to reverse parts of the welfare bill, like restoring the winter fuel payment?
Well, we're absolutely delighted. I mean, it's absolutely the right thing that needs to be done. I mean, specifically on PIP, for example, we know that there was 150,000 carers that were potentially going to lose out on their carer's allowance. And that was because if the person that they cared for no longer received PIP, then they would no longer be able to receive that carer's allowance. And the four-point system just frankly, you know, created some kind of cliff edge, which quite frankly is unworkable. I mean, people's disabilities, you know, range from mild to more severe. And I think the bill needs to recognise that and certainly find a way to make that work so it can support everyone with disabilities and not just those who've got the most severe.
Do you think these U-turns go far enough, or should more be done?
Well, I think quite honestly, obviously, the Prime Minister has just made an announcement. We're going to hear some more detail, and I welcome that. And I look forward to hearing the more detail. And I hope that he's now listened to the over 100 Labour MPs who have, you know, been rebelling on this and signing the EDM on the subject to state loud and clear that they're not happy with this either.
What further steps do you believe are needed to protect vulnerable people from potential future welfare cuts?
So what we really need to do is to understand what the root cause is of many people requiring universal credit, for example. So we know, for example, that there's a rise in long-term chronic health. We know there's a rise in mental health in children and young people. And we really need to get to the root cause of exactly what's happening so we can actually start to put prevention measures in place and support these people when they're younger, so that actually when they're older, then they don't need that support from the state. And also what this welfare bill didn't do was actually provide support to get people back into work. And if you want to get people back into work, then you actually need to support them to do so. And one of the things that I heard last night was about how the removal of the PIP payment for deaf people, for example, what that would have done is it would have removed their ability to have BSL interpreters, which completely removes their ability to work. So it was just completely counterproductive. If you want to get people back into work, then you need to actively support them to get back into work.
Moving on to the environment and water, you've criticised Thames Water for sewage dumping. What concrete steps are being taken to stop this?
Well, that's a very good question. And that's what we're continuing to hold Thames Water to account. And what we're asking Thames Water to do is to invest more in their infrastructure so it can prevent that. And I was down at one of the water sewage treatments works by the Hogsmill, and I was absolutely flabbergasted that there are times when it overspills from the sewage works. I mean, I just couldn't believe that was the case, and that they didn't have any sort of prevention measures to stop that. So really what we need to see, and we've been calling for a long time now, is for Thames Water to become a public benefit company so it can truly operate in the interests of its customers, and so that any profits that it does create are invested back into the infrastructure that support the customers, so that we can have the best water possible and just simply stop this dumping into our waterways.
You've called for a new clean water authority. How would that improve life for local residents?
Well, the new Clean Water Authority would have greater powers. And we've seen, unfortunately, that Ofwat just simply hasn't had the powers to react. I mean, recently it has been given more powers, and we welcome that. And we welcome the fact that That Ofwat has now banned and the bonuses for Thames Water, but quite simply, for many years, it's just operated without having these powers. And we know recently that Thames Water has been fined, £122 million. But this is why it needs replacing, because we need a new water authority that actually is going to do what it needs to and slap on the fines when Thames Water and other water companies don't do the right thing. So they get the message that actually you've got to do the right thing. We're holding you to account. And you can't continue to underinvest in our the water infrastructure and dump water in the waterways.
Healthcare is the next thing I want to touch on. £12 million has been pledged for Epsom and St Helier Hospital. How soon will this funding make a noticeable difference, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I think it probably depends on exactly how the hospital plan to spend it, and I don't have the details of that at the moment. But one of the things that we do know is that, quite frankly, it's just a drop in the ocean of what is required at Epsom and St Helier, because their backlog currently stands at £150 million, and that's £150 million that's existing. That doesn't take into account all the different parts of the hospital that's going to break, over the next few years. Or certainly up the next 10 years until we actually get a new hospital for St Helier. So the cost of not just the upkeep but the backlog and other future repairs is going to be greater than that.
And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will remember that you famously abseiled down the hospital building to raise awareness. Do you think such actions like this help speed up support?
Yes, absolutely. And recently I managed to ask Wes Streeting, the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care as well. And it was I asked him if he'd actually come down to St Helier and look, come and walk in the shoes of the doctors and nurses who have to experience the building on a daily basis, whether it's the windows that are stuck together with tape, the ceilings that are falling in, or the lifts that simply don't work and they can't move patients from one floor to another. So I'll continue to do whatever I can do to continue to raise and maintain the profile of the challenges that we have at St Helier.
Moving on to education, what are the main challenges SEND families in Epsom and Ewell are facing currently?
There are a litany of challenges. So there are challenges in the length of time it takes to issue EHCPs. There are challenges in the fact that they always have to, the majority of them have to go to court and then they're overturned. That's incredibly challenging. There's challenges in the authorisation for the funding to provide the child. There's challenges in terms of actually parents getting appropriate school places and the appropriate funding for the child. And there are challenges, and the places that some parents are offered are simply not suitable for children. So there are so many challenges, and I continue to work with many parents in Epsom and Ewell to try to support them the best that we can in order to get their children into school, because currently we know of a number of children who don't even have a school place in September because they don't have the funding and they don't know where they're going to go. And that's absolutely devastating, obviously, for the child who should be supported in their education, but for the parents as well.
And how is Surrey County Council addressing the long delays in SEND assessments and support?
Well, they have now been improving slightly the length of time it takes to do EHCPs, but we still would like to see further improvement. And I think one of the challenges that we've seen recently is that the schools now have to contribute £6,000 towards SEND support, and this is just creating an absolute postcode lottery for parents. And we know that school budgets are already absolutely at breaking point, and they're already having to, from their own school budgets, fund the increase in the pension contribution. So there's continual pressure on schools, and that makes it incredibly difficult.
What message do you have for those families affected?
Please contact me if you need some support. I'm here absolutely to support you, and we have had many successes in supporting children recently, but I absolutely want to make sure that those parents who have children who are currently not in school or are waiting for places, that I support them the best I can to try to make sure that they do get a place in a school.
And you did lead a debate on relationships and sex education. What changes do you think are needed for older pupils?
Yes, and I think that was really just coming from the fact that or the worry and the concern that so many kids nowadays are getting their information from social media. And it's really important that we have a conversation and we talk about what are good and what are bad relationships, and also to help young women and young men understand the signs of what a bad relationship could be. So we're just asking that more time is actually given to this in schools, and that it's not just an ad hoc lesson. It's really incorporated into the national curriculum.
And final topic, defence. The UK has pledged to increase defence spending to 5% of GDP by 2035. Do you support this commitment and how should it be funded?
Yes, absolutely. We do support this commitment. And what we have been calling for now for a number of months is cross-party talks with the Labour government and other parties in the House of Commons to try to figure out the pathway to 3%. We recognise how important it is at the moment with Putin in Russia and the invasion in Ukraine and an unreliable Trump in the US, that we have to absolutely strengthen our defence. And I was just recently in Estonia, and it was fantastic to meet the British troops out there and the French troops supporting the operation out there. And it really brings to home the challenges out there and actually how real it is. You know, this really is an existential threat to Estonia. They're right next to Russia, and they as a country absolutely feel this because they've obviously been invaded many times before, and this is something that's incredibly real. So we have to recognise this and increase our defence spending.
How do you view the UK's role in NATO's evolving defence strategy?
Well, that's been outlined in the recent strategic defence review, where it stated that we have a NATO first policy, and we will continue to do that. So obviously the mission at the moment in Estonia is a NATO mission, and that's one that we will continue to support. And then we've got 900 troops who are based out there. And we're leading that at the moment, and that will continue to be the case. And NATO will continue to talk with the other nations about how it can continue. They'll continue to grow their operations.
As Lib Dem defence spokesperson, what role do you see for the UK in EU defence initiatives post-Brexit?
Well, I think what we've said in the SDR is that we have a NATO first approach, which obviously is the majority of countries in Europe, and we will continue to work with other nations as we do at the moment, and what we do brilliantly. And it's one of the things that was really great to see when I was in Estonia is actually how well we work with those other nations, the French and Estonia. And it's not as easy as some people might think when you've got different communications equipment, you've got different vehicles, and just trying to figure that out. So it's really great to see that our brave men and women who are out there are doing a fantastic job in just figuring out how to work together.
And final question, you also chair a group on explosive weapons. What impact has this work had so far?
Yes, so it's called Explosive Ordnance and Their Impact. So what we are predominantly focusing on is demining throughout the world, and it's one of a really valuable export for the UK. We have so many incredible people, and many who are ex-British Army, who have exploded unexploded ordnance throughout the world, and particularly at the moment in Ukraine, we've got the largest amount of mines there, which is going to cause a huge problem later. And it's about sort of bringing the community together, making sure that we can get the message across that we're here to support people, we're here to help train other countries so that they can actually deal with their unexploded ordnance, and also it recognise the valuable companies that are also working in this area and providing that knowledge and expertise to other countries as well.